Welcome to the Business of Collaboration podcast. In this podcast, we try and answer the following questions. What is innovation? How do people collaborate and work together? Who is behind the most innovative ideas, technology, and knowledge? We are curious about people. How do they innovate? How do they create a new technology or acquire new knowledge? We give them a voice and a platform to share their stories because they are superheroes.
This is your host, Jara Pascual, founder and CEO of Collab With. Today we have the pleasure to talk to Professor Joe Haslam, Professor and Master of Scaling Up. Professor Joe Haslam is a Scale Up Master and Expert, Associate Professor at the Instituto de Empresa, Academic Director of Global Scale Up Program at American University of Beirut, and Monsab ESA at Saudi Arabia. In this podcast episode of Business of Collaboration, we will talk about his journey from entrepreneurship to professor and how he is changing the conversation and perspective about startups, scale-ups, slow growth, scaling up, investment, and women above 50 as a powerhouse. Do you want to know? Listen to our podcast with Professor Joe Haslam. So, vamos, vamos, vamos. Bienvenido, Joe, al podcast Business of Collaboration. Then we have to switch into English, Joe, then.
Okay, most small at this feeling very kind, that's very laugh. Okay, so go flush.
Welcome, Joe Haslam, to the podcast Business of Collaboration. And the first question for you is, what is your story from entrepreneur to associate professor in the IE in Madrid, so the Instituto de Empresa University?
Okay, well, you know, I've been on this earth a long time. First of all, thank you for the invitation and all that. It's great to be here. Yeah, whenever you ask a middle-aged man his story, you know, you go on for ages. But the very quick summary is that I was born in Ireland and I grew up in both the West and the South of Ireland. And like a lot of Irish people, I then went to London and I worked in consulting for a while. And then I went to the US and then did that for a while. Came back when the dot-com thing was really kicking off. And we set up a company called Marrakesh and we raised $70 million and scaled to 250 people. And that gave me a really lifelong interest in scaling and how to scale companies. So, you know, a lot of professors talk about startup companies and how to start things. I talk about scale up companies and how to scale things, because I guess both my parents were professors and I always had some kind of theoretical basis to everything we did. You know, there was always a mythology, and I noted that there wasn't really any methodology in terms of scaling. I mean, at that time, there wasn't even any methodology in terms of starting. You know, there was no Eric Ries or anything like that, or Steve Blank. But it was particularly bad in terms of scaling. And then when the company was sold, I came to Madrid to do an MBA in IE Business School. And that's a sort of an unusual thing. You know, most people set up companies after the MBA. So it was quite interesting that I had done that before. So they were very interested in my experience. And I guess from being the child of a professor, you know, the idea of standing in front of a class was a very natural thing. You know, we used to sit around a table discussing the events of the day. I mean, it's a sort of funny thing. You know, my father would never say, never come to dinner without the papers read, without the newspapers read. You know, you're expected to have an opinion on what was happening in the world, which is actually quite useful now in terms of because we have, of course, in IE students from all over the world, from 130 countries. So it's always interesting to be able to sort of just have a link comment, you know, you know, someone says, I'm from Armenia, you know, and then you sort of have something to say about Armenia. So that's always useful. So so that's sort of the bridge I stand, that I spend about half my time teaching. In particular, I'm the executive director of the Owner Scale Up program, which is a program directly for companies that want to scale. So that's immediately after product market fit. But I teach everything. I teach executive MBA. So those are people generally who work for large corporations. And then I also teach the MBA and I teach the MIM, who are about 24, and then the iUniversity. So, you know, you need to know your Generation Zs, your millennials, you need to know your boomers, you need to know your everyone, because they all react differently. So that's kind of why. So I've been living now in Madrid for about 16 years, which is actually longer than I've lived anywhere else. Not that I'm a Madrileño, you know, nobody ever stops and asks me for directions. Everyone knows that I'm, you know, I'm haven't really been able to blend in with the crowd.
And this is very curious because you are mentioning scale ups when you have the product market fit. And always it's like this question of, what is the product market fit? You know, the hockey stick growth, like, you know, this book about the stages.
Yeah.
So market fit with your services, product, whatever you are doing, is when you start having your first income or when you have regular income? So yeah, very technically.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing is it's literally the most important thing. I mean, in any kind of company, I mean, there's three things. First of all, that I talk about. One is that, you know, startups as a term, we need to start using the word pre-scale ups, because the scale up in a sense, if you can't scale it, there's sort of no point in doing it. It's just a hobby then, you know, that the, you know, globalization and other things. So we have to try and, you know, look to scale from the beginning. The second thing is the idea of linear versus exponential and understanding all of that. And I imagine that's something we'll get to later. But the third thing is product market fit and knowing exactly what that is, because, you know, business skills are criticized by a lot of people for, you know, what value do they bring? And, you know, sort of professors don't know anything. And you know, it's a sort of like, people can say it if they want. And I always have the defense, at least in your teaching entrepreneurship, I have the defense of having started many companies. There's this famous phrase that like a day in the library will save you 6 months in a lab. And there's no doubt that I you don't have to be the smartest person. If I've had 500 conversations with people, entrepreneurs who've scaled companies, and I've spotted what's in common between the different things, you know, I can save you a lot of time. Because while I don't perhaps have, you know, every industry is different and every time is different and the business cycle is different, I think that the mistakes tend to be the same. You know, the things people do wrong tend to be the same. The things that you need to do to make you successful might be different, yeah, but the things that you do wrong tend to be the same. So getting product market fit is absolutely important. And if you get a good product market fit, you literally can't go wrong from there. And a lot of companies like almost fool themselves into believing they have a product market fit.
Yeah, that's it. That's why I was asking, what is the point? How a company knows they have this product market fit?
Well, I mean, the analogy I use is like getting married, you know, even on your wedding day, like, were you 100% or were you 99%, you know? You're never 100%, right? That's almost impossible. And, you know, you never know 100%, but I guess the definition, I mean, just for people who are not familiar with the concept, you address a market and you have a product, and you can add and subtract features to the product, and you can add and subtract who you're targeting with the market. Yeah. And the idea is to get the two of them aligned. So, you know, you may decide to have a certain product that includes certain things, or you may decide to have a more simplified targeted product. Similarly with a market, you may decide to address a wider group of people or else a very fixed group of people. So those are the options you have that you're playing with. And then you have to, you know, match the two of them together. Now, when do you have that? My answer to that is that the market tells you, you know, you don't decide, which, you know, I don't know. You could also say that's a bit about marriage, you know, as well. Like, you know, I remember I getting my own case. My wife is Spanish and one of the things that tell, you know, this goes back so long, but TV commercials were really long and they used to be like 10 minutes. You can probably remember this. It wasn't impossible in the popular shows. you know, there was literally, you could have a 10 minutes of a commercial break. And like, we were living together and we were always planning on getting married. But, you know, I was always like, you know, can we just get this milestone over with? And she started like, you know, get a casarme. Yeah. You know, and I like, it was sort of, it just started like that. And she said, get a casarme, tener hijos. And but it was kind of like a, you know, I didn't have it long enough to resist. Like if the TV ad break had been shorter, maybe the show would have come back on and I would have been able. But she had it. I said, okay, nos casamos en septiembre. And she had enough time to ring her mother, her sister, her aunt, and her grandmother. And at that stage, then there was, you know, there was no stopping it then. So at that stage, and, you know, we're together 15 years and very happy. But the interesting part is that product market fit is a bit the same, that, you know, the market comes to you and says, we want your product, you know, and we want more of your product. And we want your product to be in different languages. And we want your product to be, you know, available in this version, you know. So whenever you have to convince the market, there is, you still haven't found, you know, that kind of thing that you know, that everyone wants, that lightning in a bottle, that secret sauce, that all of those things. So, you know, you the example I often give is Airbnb. You know, they had like all these people in countries they'd never opened offices who were just going onto the site and saying, drop down list Azerbaijan, drop down this Baku, drop down list, you know, district, government district, you know, and then upload the photos and you know, away you go. And when the market comes to you and insists, you know, that you need to get bigger, that then means you have product market fit. And when you have to try and push it, whether it's with Facebook and Google Ads or with any sort of, you know, things, that suggests that you should maybe go a few more innovation cycles, that you should maybe do some more experiments and refine your product a bit more before it's ready to scale. Because simplicity scales and complexity kills. So the more simple you can make your product, the more chance you'll have to rapidly scale.
Yeah, totally. And I think that's a very good definition. And it's not easy to know this definition, because you have in accelerators or other books completely different definitions, and then people are getting confused.
Yeah.
And as well, investors. And I was coming now, like, there is a relationship of product market fit with sales funnel. When you are trying to sell, you are pushing people out. And when the people are coming to you to look for your product, is when the sale is done. Yeah. So it's more to, and I don't know if there is, how you see this relationship. There is a relationship between how you do the things around your business, you know, everything together.
Yeah.
Like the people are coming to you, instead of maybe you are doing things are not properly correct, and then you have to always knock the doors, you know.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing about sales, you know. I mean, people talk about sales is less about selling and more about, you know, working out how much the person can pay, you know, like the sales should almost be already done, and that the you know, that the job of the salesperson is to work out how much they can pay and to work out like when it arrives and, you know, these kind of things. And that, again, indicates a good product market fit, that you know, literally the person comes pre-done. They're like, yeah, oh, we've heard of your product. It's amazing. We want it. And when you have to be explaining it, that suggests that you haven't created the viral effect. You haven't delighted the customers. But, you know, people are reluctant always to simplify their product into a way that it can go viral, because, you know, it does. You might simplify it in a way that you might take out the good stuff. Like, that's always a risk, right? And like, so I understand that's why people are reluctant to do it. But the truth is that, you know, you have to give yourself a chance, that if you don't take hard decisions, you don't fail, you just stop. You know, you mm-hmm. to fail, you have to have tried. You have to have said, okay, we need to do something that gives us a chance at kind of hitting escape velocity. We do need to do something. And, you know, at least if you do that and it doesn't work, you can say you tried. But if you didn't try, is it any surprise that you failed? And if you look at companies that really have scaled, you know, a lot of them have like one big product, you know. In the case of Amazon, I guess that the marketplace, Apple, the iPhone, Facebook have the mobile feed. So, you know, this idea of really focusing on one thing and really making that kind of go as fast as it can. So there's books like The Power of One and The Simplicity and these kind of things. But I think in general, people probably need to spend more time pre-product market fit than they want to. The reason they always give that they can't do it is because they don't have funding or these kinds of things. I'm a big believer in going slowly and profitably rather than going a kind of a blitz scale or a fast way, because nature tells us anything that grows fast can collapse. I'm old enough now to have seen companies like Yahoo. Yahoo was once invincible. Now it doesn't even really exist. So, you know, that's the kind of the way of, and particularly in Europe, European is the idea is that we do things slowly but better. And that's a very kind of, rather than perhaps the Chinese or the Silicon Valley way, which tends to be hyperscaling and blitzscaling. So, I always talk to European founders about doing things slowly and profitably. And that's the way to grow.
Yeah, but sometimes, for instance, here in the Netherlands, last year, it was like there is this kind of award of the most faster growing companies. You know, like yeah. it's a prize, it's an award.
Yeah.
And then it was very curious. The company was Takeaway, you know, the delivery.
Yes, yeah.
And because they were doing merchant acquisitions of different markets, the same product there, and they were growing very, very, very fast. And at the same time, some people from Takeaway were coming to my workshops, and they were suffering.
Yeah.
A lot, and the management was not able to lead with this. So my question was like, how they will make it. Yeah. You know, you have to have this specific skills, like you mentioned, for every phase, you have to do different things of leadership to protect your people and make them grow together with the business. And this is very difficult if you are growing very fast.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you see they were scaling different countries. So, and I know you have a very nice definition and difference between growth and scaling. I would like you explain what this different it is.
Well, I mean, this is, again, people often, I tell people this and they say things like, I wish I'd met you 10 years ago or, you know, these kind of things. But, there's an awful lot of, why do you have the owner scale up program? Like, why do you talk about scaling all the time as opposed to growing or whatever? And I always say that growth is linear and scaling is exponential. And what I'm about is the other thing, of course, is that you scale a business model. You don't scale a product. A product is a product, but like, although business model is a very businessy school kind of word, it's a real thing and it's an important thing. And you can't scale a product, but a business model is how, you know, that's about how you capture clients, how you retain them, how you, you know, give them support, how you price them. You know, there's a whole series of things within that are relevant, whereas a product just has a sort of a transactional thing. And all you're doing really as a startup is you're trying to find a scalable and repeatable business model. And because of that, it's a sort of like, and then when you find that can scale. And you want to try and catch an exponential wave, which is sort of now exponentiality, just explain that for you as well. Linear growth is 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. Whereas exponential growth is 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64. And if you can see the graph, you're quite slowly growing and then the exponential effect kicks in and suddenly, you know, you're everywhere. And, you know, one of the things about the pandemic is people are starting to understand that. But you can see exponential growth in your data before you actually have exponential growth on the street. You know, that you can, and this is that what good investors can do, which is they're happy to invest because they can see that you're conforming to an exponential growth model. So that even though you don't have the, you know, the numbers as yet, you can see you're on that track. And that's why these exponential modelers, epidemiologists and, you know, physicists and, you know, who do all this stuff, that they can spot. So what you're trying to do is set up a business model so it can capture exponential growth. And, you know, that's just very different to the conventional way of managing companies, which is around management, you know, in the sort of like the way that, you know, companies were managed in the 80s and 90s and those kind of things. Like, it's much more, you know, it's all about meetings and, you know, those kind of things. And like, you know, slowly, and you add 20% per year and stuff like and you know, that's not at all what it's about in terms of scaling. Scaling is a very definite thing whereby you experiment, you double down on what works. And then by doing that, you keep on doubling down, and then you hit an exponential curve. And that makes you almost unstoppable. And the SaaS companies, like, you know, why they are unstoppable is because of this, you know, that they have kind of solved a problem in a way that literally the problem they're solving for, they can't live without it. And as their business grows, the SaaS can also grow with them in a way that means they get more money without really having to do anything further, you know? Yeah. So it's a wonderful business model, and this is why these SaaS companies are really interesting models to study. But if you can set yourself up for exponential growth, when your exponential growth happens, it's a wonderful business.
Yeah, it's like, let me check with the nature example you were mentioning. When you are in exponential growth, first you have to design this from the beginning.
Yeah.
So in we can say, in the first phase, like, you are almost at asymptote flat in the graph.
Yeah.
It's when you have to experiment, and as well you have to seed. You have to put a lot of seeding. It's like when in the COVID, when the doctors, they were explaining, it's like, why was this explosion? And it's because it was a lot of seeding. They identify a lot of a small focus of the COVID disease in different parts. And when you have these kind of dots everywhere, is when suddenly you can, like, bloom, explosion, because they are all connected somehow.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like this for companies as well. You have to spend your time seeding yourself as a business,
yeah,
and as well making these experimentations a lot of time.
Yeah, it's all about
any kind of growth.
Yeah. You know, it's everything. I mean, I you've explained it very well there. And actually, it conforms a lot to the way science is done in terms of, like, pharmaceutical drugs and these kind of things. But I explain it, it's like moving away from your, like, low margin customers and towards your high margin customers. You know, you're sort of, yeah, like adding features to see, can we then increase our prices and without losing customers? You know, you're doing these kind of experiments, which is, as you say, refining. And, you know, those, but the thing is that you want to do that, you know, before product market fit, if possible, because then when you have product market fit, I mean, it's the same with the vaccines, you know, like they have all these candidates, and then they do trials, and then they pick one, and then they get behind that, and then they scale that up, you know, mm-hmm. And they don't scale up the ones that were nearly right, or they, you know, they disregard them. And it's as bizarre that, you know, people would run products in their experiment and they have some things right, but they're not the best one, that they would still scale those up. I'm like, Pfizer are not scaling up the vaccines that kind of worked, but not really. No, they fire up the best one. So it's really a process of experimentation, and it's really a process of, you know, there are other analogies as well about, like, you know, there's something called good cholesterol and bad cholesterol in the body, and one of them is really good to have and the other isn't so good, and you've got to try and move away from the bad to the good. So these are the sort of things that you're working out, because, like, then the idea of venture capital is that you do have the product market fit, and then you get venture capital as growth capital. And then you just use that money for opening offices and, you know, recruiting, you know, warehouses and predictable things, you know, like the risk is kind of gone from the business at that stage. So it's just an operational matter. And then, so that's a perfect time to take capital, and that's a perfect way to scale the business. But if you take venture capital too early, you know, you're on their timetable, you know, of the investors, and you're also, you're using money for working capital rather than you should be getting your money from customers at that stage. And then you take your growth capital from investors because you've managed to isolate something that's of enormous value. And then all you have to do is let more people find out about this, and then they will also want it too, inevitably. And then the business scales. And, you know, I always tell people that it's easier to run a 500 person business than a 50 person business. You
yeah,
know?
Totally. That's a part of the MBA I was having always, the thing like, okay, now I am ready for a big company, you know, but now I have to start from scratch, a new one. Where are the tools here?
Yeah. But I know people who run 500 person companies, and they, some of them don't do anything. You know, they literally like, you know, they go to the office for 4 hours kind of thing, you know. They're available when they need to be, you know. And obviously there are some things that only they can do, like presenting results and board meetings and those kind of things. But they're not really under any stress, you know. They're, you know, well, I mean, perhaps there are issues and people leaving and stuff like that. But they don't, it's really hard when you're at that 150 person number, the Dunbar number kind of thing, because you're brought into everything. You're kind of close enough to be brought into the detail, but then you also have to do the other stuff as well. But there are people I do coaching and you know, like these guys are very easy to get. They're always available, and they, you know, they just kind of they're there. Like it's like, they describe it as their, you know, management by moments, you know, like that there are certain things that they do that are really important that they get right. Yeah. And that's what they totally focus on. And then to enable them to be free for that, they purposely avoid all the other stuff. And I think that's fair enough. I wouldn't criticize that in any way.
Mm-hmm. So then, like, now we know all your knowledge. How did you get all the knowledge of the key factors of success for scale-ups and businesses?
Well, I started before anybody else, which was a kind of a key factor. If you go to the Wikipedia in scaling, apparently somebody wrote that I invented the term, which was kind of like,
oh, really?
I don't know who it was who wrote it or something, but you know, there's this book by David Epstein called Range, and he talks about how, you know, being part of different disciplines allows you to see things before other people. And, you know, I've had a range of careers, and perhaps that gave me insights into different areas, and I could put the pieces together. And, you know, I was one of the first people to see the importance of scaling. And I mean, I absolutely didn't invent the term, and people like Bern Harnisch have, you know, deserve a lot more credit for this than me. But I certainly saw its value. And then, you know, I don't think in IE they really, when we did this course, I don't think they really understood it, but it was sort of easier because of the enthusiasm, it was sort of easier to just let me do it, and if it fails, whatever, you know. But I don't think they really understood it. So we have been running this course now for 9 years, and you know, because of that, you know, I must have talked to 500 entrepreneurs, and you know, been following it, and that's sort of where the knowledge comes from. The other thing, part of my job is that I travel a lot, so I would travel to maybe, you know, before the pandemic, it would have been 20 weeks a year on the road, which is, I mean, by choice. I quite like doing that. And I'm fortunate that my wife's mother and sister, aunt and grandmother all live on the same street as me. So they hardly notice that I'm gone. You know, it's like, I don't have this big scene where I'm like leaving my wife and kids, and, you know, they're literally like, I literally slip out the door and my wife is sort of like, I'm not leaving her. But the interesting part is that you know, that allows you to see the contrast. So I'd see how companies scale in Colombia, how they scale in the Middle East, you know, what are the factors there? And then that allows you to see patterns beyond the European Silicon Valley kind of stuff. But it really is that I just sort of, you know, found, having been through this experience myself and knowing how important it was to scale, I just started to sort of pay attention to this. And just whenever I would hear of a company that scaled, just make it my business to try and understand how they did it. And that's really where it came from. So I think anyone else could have, just that I sort of took a decision. And I think that's true in a lot of disciplines. You know, I mean, maybe you have your Einsteins who can do, you know, mathematical formula, but in a lot of other cases, you just take the decision that this is what you're interested in. Mm-hmm. And you then pursue it more than other people, and that's what makes you an expert.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, for sure. Like, it's going deep into the topic, you know, and have this curiosity, and like, I want to know more. How do you, you know, this curiosity, and as well, it's coming with the time.
Yeah, but it happens over. I mean, I think also the impact you can have is quite it's quite interesting. You know, just you have, there are always this contrast between the founder and the scaler, you know, and it used to be
scaler.
yeah it used to be very fashionable for VCs to fire the founder, you know, that used to be the thing they would do. You know, they would, like, so the founder would start the company and then they would fire it and bring in like the MBA with the button-down shirt and, you know, impeccable manners, and, you know, that would be the person they would want to run the company, as opposed to the sort of hustler type founder. But fortunately, that's gone now, and they understand that the founder has a unique perspective and they're worth keeping around, and you can help the founder by bringing in people with the skills perhaps that the founder doesn't have. But essentially, there are things that only a founder can say and can you know, make people animar a la gente, make people rise to challenges. That, so the founder is worth keeping. But
and so, I want to coach them how to grow personally, yeah, and in the leadership skills.
Yeah. This is the point I was going to make, which is that you know, a lot of founders, like, they didn't really understand the scaling up phase of the business, you know, and it was sort of, it was almost as if when I started to explain to them what they had been through, you know, then they started to kind of, I was like, did this happen? And then this happened. And then this usually happens. And then they would like look at me as if to say, yeah, that's actually exactly everything, you know. And then that was, then it made sense. And then I was able to also say to them, look, and right, and now the next three things that are going to happen to you are this, 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 and this. And then when it did happen to them, they were like, first of all, they were comforted by the fact that it wasn't the only person this was happening to.
Totally.
Which was a huge, you know, because founders are very self-critical and entrepreneurs are very, it can be a lonely existence. So when I tell them, like, this is what's going to happen to you, and it happens, they're like, okay, well, this is kind of what Joe said. You know, I remember, I think I like this wife of a guy I was coaching, and one day his wife called me up and she said, I don't know who you are and I don't know what you do, but she said, thank you for giving me my husband back.
Wow.
And I didn't really understand, kind of, it took me a while to really understand. You know, English wasn't their native language. And it was like, and it turned out that, you know, I had been kind of saying to him, like, it's okay to do this and not do this. And he had been like trying to manage the company, you know, before it had scaled. And it just, the pressure of him had just turned him into a difficult person to live with.
Yeah.
And I had kind of broken it down for him in a way that, you know, that had kind of got him working on the hard stuff. And, you know, it was a sort of like, you know, I have to say, you know, when someone says something like that to you, you think, well, you know, at least I did something good. You know, maybe not everyone listens to me, but I do remember that day as being a good day.
But Joe, this is true, because like, almost you are making me super emotional, because when you, as a, you know, as a founder myself, it's so tough, like, you as a woman, maybe I, or because whatever I am, in the business of innovation many years, and I like to go deep into analysis of collaboration, innovation, entrepreneurship. And I am more aware of the balance I have to have in my mind, mm-hmm. and how to, like, what I have to do to perform better with my mind. And this is the part you have to take care, like, you are not pushing too much, because you can, the stress you have in your mind is so high.
Yeah.
Like, even say putting your kids in bed is a stress, is too much, you know?
Yeah.
Because you have too much pressure everywhere. Yeah. So it's very important, like, when you recognize this, or someone is telling you, like, it's okay to have these 2 hour breaks between kids are coming from school until you put in bed.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's super crazy, but it's like to have this kind of peaceful mind at that moment. So in the weekends, in some slots, is and as well to have time for your husband, you know, for your partner, yeah. and to enjoy with a free of stress in your mind. That's, you have first to know, like, you have to do this. Second, how to do it.
Yeah, no, it's very true. And I mean, I often use this phrase that the way it should be is that the worst day working for yourself is better than the best day working for somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's the definition of, you know, why we put ourselves through this, that there's this calling that we can't kind of not respond to. So, you know, that's often the way I set up the thing, which is to say, but then, you know, the enjoyment of it. And the best entrepreneurs, like serial entrepreneurs, like, will tell you that the only time they feel okay is when they're, like, challenging for something or trying mm-hmm. to reach something. Yeah, but that's right. Like, that's the only sort of time they feel okay. And you know, a friend of mine just did an exit, has a $6 million or €6 million into his bank accounts, and has now started another company almost immediately. And he, you know, I mean, he was saying kind of like, you know, I get a pain in my hand and I think it was cancer, you know, like, is that, like, that kind of thing. Or I would, like, you know, just, you know, it's just the only thing that he, and he's like, I wasn't meeting any interesting people. You know, he said that entrepreneurship is tough. He said, but, you know, it's a way of challenging yourself. It's a way of overcoming. And the best feeling, he said, I would arrive at the end of the week and I would think I've done nothing useful. And that, then I wouldn't be able to enjoy the weekend. You know, and that's like all of those things. So, like, it is possible, very possible, that you enjoy the ride, you know, you enjoy the whole thing. And that's not something that you should think, you know, it's not possible to get rich and to enjoy. That's not the case. But you do have to be able to ask for help. You do have to be able to, particularly with other founders, you know. I say that one of the things we do in the Owner Scale Up program is that you're just in contact with other founders who can kind of give you the incentive to fix things and attract problems that perhaps, you know, like, if you're sitting in a room, if I'm a professor and I say everyone should have a coach, right? And someone could be listening to that and saying, oh yeah, well, maybe you might think of that. And then if I go around the room and all the other 8 people all have a coach, then suddenly you're thinking, okay, you know, that's the trigger, you know, that's what will make you do it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we find that all the time. People will say, you know, ripping out their technology stack and putting in a new one, you know, people were putting that off. But having heard from other people who did it and it worked out better, it was the trigger that enabled them to move forward. And the other thing I often say is working on hard problems. I mean, if you fail at a hard problem, it's not really a failure. Like, psychological damage comes from failing at easy problems. You know, you talk about putting your kids to bed, you know, that a lot of the stress, you know, they think it's, you know, American TV shows and things, you know, always have that kind of mother who feels she's not a good mother. And, she always reacts to like not getting the easy stuff right. It's always like there's no orange juice in the fridge, so she suddenly thinks she's a bad mother, you know, which is like, that's the things that, you know, drag you down. But, you know, but if you try to set it up in terms of an ambitious goal and you fail at that, then you just kind of, okay, reorganize and go again. So you'll maybe achieve half of that goal. But it doesn't do as much damage to you psychological when you fail. You're saying like, this is difficult. So the fact that I'm not getting it right is the way it should be. So I focus people always towards people. Some people come to me and they say like, you know, I'm having difficulty doing this. And I'm like, you know, in some ways, like the problem isn't big enough. I'm like, and then I tell them the solution is to kind of raise, you know, make your targets 10 times bigger. And like that wasn't what they're expecting at all. But that's actually the solution, which is to say, no, your problem is that you need to raise your stuff 10 times bigger, and that will make you very serious about what you're doing. And that's you know, those kind of things are, you know, just what I got from hearing loads of other people say them, and I wrote them down, and you know, that's where it comes from. There's no great mystery.
And then you mentioned before, and I think we agree in the previous call, it's about the value of money. So how can entrepreneurs recognize this value of money and the value of a slow growth and taking care of the business? Because it's, you know, like the bakery you have in the corner, like they are taking care of the customers, you know, they are selling. And this is how business work. And sometimes it's difficult with venture capital and investment, like to value what is the real value of money and what you are doing as a business, you know?
Well, it's interesting, like the elective I teach in the MBA, it's 15 women founders that I interview. And a lot of them have very successful businesses because, as they say it, they're like, men didn't understand my business and didn't give me money, and it was men who had the money. So there was one company, I don't know whether I can give you all the details, but she was telling me that they had a competitor that was funded by a man, and of course he had all that macho stuff and all his bros gave him, his bros gave him all the money. And, it blew up, you know, basically indigestion, you know, basically too much money too fast, therefore using money to solve problems rather than actually asking yourself what the problem. And then she had, couldn't raise the money, so had to be very capital efficient, had to try and solve the problems. But because of that, found a very good product market fit. And that's why she said for certain, if she had got the same amount of money, the company wouldn't be there. So too much money too quickly will kill a company, you know. And even the other thing that, you know, this is not a new thing, but the idea that like nothing kills a bad product like good marketing. In other words, that if you have good marketing that sets some people up for an amazing experience and then they're disappointed, you will never see these people again.
Yeah.
And like that is a typical, you know, too much money company, that they have the money, so they spend the marketing and they prime the customer, but they haven't spent the time in product development. So then when they create the buzz and everyone flies in, and then it's not a good experience, then it's just the company, you know, never really recovers. Yeah. So that's, you know, again, very much, you know, grow slowly and profitably. The other thing is, of course, is that, you know, if you make profits, I mean, first of all, you you want, in the early days, you probably want engagement more than money. But, you know, money is useful because, like, I talk to a lot with social innovation companies, and, you know, I always say to them, you know, try and run your business with a profit so you don't have to depend on a foundation, because the foundation can pull the funding or something like that. So like, don't be afraid of profits. You know, profits are not a dirty word. You can provide healthcare and schooling or whatever it is, And still make a profit. And then that profit is what you used for your working capital and stuff like that. And then, you know, nobody can touch you. But if you kind of are all the time depend, if you're not getting money from customers and you're getting it from a foundation, you know, the foundation, well, two things. First of all, you need to spend all your time writing reports for the foundation. So they'll, you know, but the second thing is if something happens to them and they pull the funding, then you're completely gone because the way you've set up the business model is not working. So it's sort of exactly the same that if you can get your money from customers to fund the business, then that's a much more stable you know, way of growing the business.
You are listening to the Business of Collaboration podcast, a production from CollabWith. We are an online community helping businesses connect with experts to solve innovation challenges and create consortiums. We do this through a custom-built environment where academics, startups, and businesses collaborate to innovate and accelerate. Together, we break down the barrier between academics and the business world. Innovation has never been so accessible. And now, back to our podcast.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned a very good point as well for social entrepreneurship and impact, maybe, business. Like, money means you bring more value and impact to the market.
Yeah.
If you have more money, more impact. And then this is the shift in the flipping mind when then we have to get money from the customers because we are bringing more value, more money, more value, more value, more money.
Yeah, it's kind of a flywheel effect, they often call it. I mean, momentum is such a powerful thing in companies, for everything from just employing people, retention. You know, a lot of companies just develop a momentum, sometimes unfairly, but it can be an amazing thing when it gets going, that you start to feel, you know, you have a belief in the company, therefore you take more risks, you know, you're not afraid. And you find a lot of companies that they just got developed a momentum. And that was what got them, you know, over the chasm and got them into a situation where they had a sustainable business. So yeah, don't never be as a social entrepreneur. I mean, the principles are actually the same as company building in the terms of doubling down on what works. I mean, Bill Clinton had said, you know, he was talking about the education reform, and he said, like, you know, we know the solutions that work, but, you know, not everyone knows them. You know, like all the experiments have kind of been run. So there could be someone in Wisconsin somewhere that has run this school thing that is working really well. But the problem is other people don't know about those things. He said, so the challenge of education reform was not to, you know, to run the experiments, but to find out what experiments had worked and then to scale those up. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of the similar case I find in impact investing, which is your job is to find out what experiments have worked and then to scale those up rather than to be, you know, necessarily to run your own stuff. Because in the areas of healthcare and education, energy, you know, there are a lot of things have already been tried. So, you know, look for the things that work, have worked, and then scale those up and then stop doing the other stuff, which is exactly the same as a non-social impact venture.
So now we are going to another direction. There is a myth about young 20-something are the stereotype of a successful entrepreneur, but statistics are showing us that from 40 years old entrepreneurs are the most successful, including women over 50. Can you explain this,
please? Yeah, this is like, it's funny. I often keep this statistic for, you know, maybe when I'm giving a presentation and the, you know, the atmosphere, you know, no presentations, like a masterclass is an hour and 20 minutes, you know, nobody can be like hold people's attention for an hour and 20 minutes. So I often sort of like, I pull this out during the, in the presentation as a way of kind of like, cause it really does wow people, me included. You know, I didn't know until recently. But yeah, that the, you know, the statistically the best age to start a company is 45. And for women, it's even higher. And it's so good that, you know, if a woman over 50 pitches you a business, just give her the money. You know, don't even, you know, the success rate is so good for women over 50 that, you know, just give her the money, you know, like, here you go. Like, because, and there are reasons for that. I mean, so few women over 50 set up businesses, that the ones that do are just have this incredible determination that they run through walls and do all that stuff. So, you know, the challenge of it is often that sometimes that the reason women over 50 set up businesses is for, you know, sort of negative reasons. Maybe they've had a divorce or they've been fired from a company in a power struggle or, you know, something like that. But very often, and, you know, I mean, the case I talk about all the time is J.K. Rowling, you know, and she would never have written the Harry Potter books if she hadn't had a divorce. You know, if she was a happy housewife in Portugal, you know, there would have been no Harry Potter, you know. But because of what happened to her, you know, and her marriage breaking down, she needed something to make her look forward. You know, she wanted, she set herself the target of walking into Waterstones in Edinburgh and there would be her book, you know, and as we know, it turned out to be much more than that. But and there are other examples as well of you know, women who, you know, what you're starting to get now is that, you know, frustration with just bad products, particularly clothing and, you know, underwear and, you know, or even in broadcasting where like women's point of view weren't on the air and stuff like that. So you do find that a lot of women are, you know, it has taken something to happen in their lives to give them the trigger moment to sort of say, you know, I'm going to make this important. So, you know, when I speak to governments and governments ask me about this, I often say, you know, your women is your underused asset. Yeah. That's what you need. That's where you need to go. But a lot of women, you know, they don't know this, and you know, they perhaps think, you know, that. But like the really funny thing, of course, is when you look at the early stage of their career, you know, how you progress in organizations. If you think of any large organization, it's just all a power struggle. There's no collaboration. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all like, it's all of those kind of, shall we say, male characteristics. But when you're building a business, it's female characteristics, it's mm-hmm. networking. So it turns out that you could be an absolutely terrible kind of, you know, like, how would I put it? IBEX 25 executive. But all of the things that make you a very good IBEX 25 executive are not the things that make you a good entrepreneur, because very often to be a good IBEX 25 executive, you know, just have to have like, you know, cold blood running through your veins and, you know, those kinds of things, rather than, you know, innovation is connecting the unconnected. It's about, you know, making people trust you. It's about building networks. It's about, you know, all of those kind of things. So the thing I found sometimes is speaking to women, is that, you know, a lot of women felt they weren't very good at this thing called business. You know, she was, you know, like I remember speaking to a woman once, and she was like, this was in Dublin. And she was like, yeah, she said, like, I had a job and in a company, but I never really, you know, I never became the managing director. I was never promoted. And it turned out that she just wasn't this kind of power hungry, you know, person, short, you know, cut corners, power hungry, you know, all those kind of things. And those are the people who rise in organizations. And so she just thought like that was what business was about. And I was saying to her, well, no, actually, that's not what business is about. You know, all of the things that come naturally to you are actually what business was about, you know, which I've mentioned, collaboration, you know, building a platform, making people trust you, communication skill, you know, all like that's actually what business is about. But in a certain kind of organization, none of those things are valued. Yeah. But outside of that, all of those things are valued. I remember, yeah, I mean, and she's flying it now, you know, and I don't think by any means my conversation might have, you know, given half of 1% in the right direction. But she just never thought of it like that. You know, she just always thought that business was a thing, you know, making money was a thing. And the way you would do that in Banco Santander was the same way you would do that in like selling Spanx or something, you know. And that was like, that wasn't the case at all. So, and that's true for women. And then for men, and actually for women, but, you know, we always say that, you know, knowing an industry in depth is what's really useful.
Yeah.
You know, there is this thing about that's completely wrong, in my opinion, you know, that you're this disruptive outsider, you know, that I've had no experience in like whatever the retail business. But that's a positive because I can just come in with fresh eyes. And I just, I mean, that's just such a ludicrous thing that.
But this is, you know, this paradox. You remember in innovation, you have this open innovation and the whole story about the crowdsourcing of knowledge is like, we will find someone from outside aerospace who can solve the problem, you know? And as well, sometimes they have the kids, like they are not experts. And then you put a complex problem there and say like, okay, how would you solve this problem? You know, and this is could be always this kind of paradox. But really, when you do business successfully, you have.
I think there are situations where an outsider and a fresh pair of eyes might be useful. But in general, you know, 20 years in the logistics business, you know, you understand, you know, where the problem is, you know, and then you can go set up a company that has the next generation. Yeah. But like, you know, this, like, I, you know, I think you're doing a disservice to someone who spent a long time in an industry getting to know it, that, let me just pick a number of the air, like 80% of it will be the same, you know, but then there is maybe a 20% of it that you can kind of find that's different and, you know, maybe provide a specialist service that had been between the gaps. So this is the idea that you find that, you know, getting good education is important and then spending 20 years in a company and then at 45 starting company. And, you know, at age 45, there are so many things that that you do better. You know, you sort of like, you don't worry as much about what other people think of you, hopefully. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, you know, back in the schoolyard, I remember, you know, you have, like, you understand that there are some things are serious, like contracts, you know, mean something. You're better off at when you see repeated behaviors, you know, like when I see someone being nasty to kind of certain people, I know now that's not a one-off thing. And I just know I don't need to wait for that to happen again.
This is toxic, gone,
you know, and I don't agonize over it in a way perhaps I did before. I would have thought, oh, you know, we have to try and
it will not work.
Not gonna work. We're not gonna have that around here. So and then it's just kind of, you know, slowly kind of, you know, just kind of poco a poco, you know, you sort of like you set your targets and you work through it. And I mean, I'll give you an example. I had a hotel booking company and we had a competitor, myself and another guy, we were in our 40s. And, you know, we did this kind of XML deal with booking.com. And, you know, like my business partner had been in the travel business for 30 years. He knew all of the people in booking.com. He knew how to pitch them, and he knew kind of how to follow up. So he just made a phone call and it was all done, you know. And we had a competitor of, you know, these guys in their 20s, you know, and there was just that route wasn't open to them, you know, like they would have, like, for them to do a deal with booking.com, I mean, you know, it was just almost impossible. They would have had to like spend months and months, talk to the right person, convince them, get to know them, understand what they needed, all that kind of thing. Whereas, you know, we were able to do it in an afternoon. So that's like another example of how having experience means, you know who to call, how to pitch them. And maybe you can't run around like with all the energy and enthusiasm, you know, of somebody half your age, but at the same time, you know, you can attack the problem in the right way. I call it the penguin problem, which is, you know, that there's no penguins in the North Pole, you know. So first time entrepreneurs are, you know, gung ho looking for penguins in the North Pole, but you're not going to find any. They're all in the South Pole. Whereas, you know, serial entrepreneurs and older entrepreneurs, we just know penguins, South Pole, you know. And I don't know whether that works. That story sometimes makes, you know, is very deep and profound. Other times it's just stupid. But yeah, you have a lot of the penguin problem, which is that just people, you know, going with enthusiasm and idealism just in a kind of a completely wrong direction. And, you know, direction is more important than speed. You know, if you're going in the wrong direction, actually speed is a negative. So that's what we tend to do. So we would tend to get, in that case, we just got an awful lot accomplished quite quickly because we knew how to put the pieces together. So that's maybe why, you know, people, 45-year-old entrepreneurs are more successful.
Yeah, totally. So what does a new entrepreneur has to do as a first step? Because you were mentioning the importance of partnerships and collaboration. And what does it mean? So what is the first step?
So, well, the first thing is that you find the people before you find the business, you know? So people who speak to me about they want to set up their own business, I say to them, find other people to set it up with before you even get the idea, right? You know, but then they say, like, how'll I convince somebody to work for me with, if I don't even know on what? Like, if I said to you, let's go set up a business, you'd say, what are we going to do? And then I would say to you, we haven't worked that out yet, but you have a set of characteristics that we work well together. You know, you always laugh at my jokes and I'm eternally grateful for that. And I need somebody on my team that laughs at my jokes, something like that. Okay. So it's like, it's that kind of stuff. So you, first of all, the people are more important than the business. You know, the business will change. So if I said to you, let's go set up a business, you know, making water bottles, you know, that business in 6 months, we might end up going in a different direction, you know, but you are still the person as part of the team. So that's why the person is more important. So the time to set up a business is when you find somebody you want to work with. That's the key. And then there are ideas, you'll find them. There are loads of them. That's not really a problem. You just start in one direction and that will lead you in other directions.
Yeah, because it takes time to find the right first team. You will change the team all the time until you don't find the team really. That's why it's very funny when investors say, no, I invest in the team. Well, oof. You know, I don't know how do you see this co-founder.
Yeah, yeah.
Issues and everything around, you know. I am finding here now a lot of CTOs living when they really build the products. And when I am asking why, investor, blah, 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 or my co-founder, blah, blah, or another investor or some, you know, like there is always this kind of thingy. So team is it's a complex thing. It's not so
easy. Of course it is. But the team is important. But the other thing is that companies, the only thing you're doing, I mean, it's like, the only thing you're doing is searching for a repeatable and scalable business model. Like all companies fail for one reason and one reason only, which is they don't find a business model. Mm-hmm. So like if you find a business model, then you it's funny, you don't fight with your competitor, your co-founders. You don't have difficulty raising money. You don't have difficulty hiring talent. You know, they're all become a product. So when you speak to people about why their company failed, they will very often give you one of those reasons. But the truth is that, you know, the company failed because it didn't kind of succeed in getting a business model. And like that often that's a sign that, you know, it's bad enough to fail. But if you're unable to say why you failed, that's a real negative.
The honesty.
Yeah. There's a sort of like, you know, that's sort of, so that's your job. Your job is to find a repeatable and scalable business model and nothing else. And the other things are kind of a distraction. So it's almost again, like a good business plan is a list of experiments. You know, it's not, I mean, I know we teach people to do business plans in terms of like product, solution, team, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But in general, my favorite description of a business, like in workshops, is that like, okay, so I write down all the unknowns, you know, on one side of the paper. And then I say, right, the job of scaling this business is to move things from the unknown to the known column. Like, and the more things that you can move between the two indicates your progress. So that's like, you know, will something work? You know, will like all of these kind of things that you're trying to work out, whether they're true or not. And then you're kind of running experiments to find out if they're true. And then when you start moving, when the thing starts working, is when everything is very quickly moving to the kind of known column. And that's really what the job is, you know. Mm-hmm. The job is to try and move stuff from things you don't know about, whether it's related to whatever, you know, we don't know whether this will work or not. We don't know whether we can find these people. We don't know whether we can, you know, whatever the problems are. And you just write them all down and then try and solve them by moving them into the other column. And maybe that's a sort of like, it's not very glamorous definition of entrepreneurship, but essentially that's what it is. That's everything you're doing. You're moving from the unknown to across to the known column. And when they're in the known column, then they cease to become a factor.
Yeah, so, that could be one of the reasons of the wrong assumptions. And as well, when they are, I don't know, to say failing or whatever, but because in the business model canvas, like everyone is using, you have to figure out and say everything like you don't know.
Yeah.
And then you are like faking it, no? Yeah. Somehow. So that's
the canvas, the business model canvas and also the lean startup are useful tools, but they're not the only way, you know, to sometimes people, in the case of the lean startup, people try to get lean too quickly, you know, and that's not necessarily the best thing either. You know, if you sometimes you take out all the fat, then there's no flavor left in the dish. And so I know there's an operations professor I work with, and he said like everyone tries to get too lean too quickly, and it's sort of like a crash diet, you know, that it's just not stable. And then with the business model canvas, the middle well canvas is it's actually more useful. Going backwards, it's very often more useful to explain why a company succeeded rather than in the other direction, you know. And I've met Alex and absolutely I wouldn't be critical of what he's done, but it turns out to be really useful in explaining what a company did well, but not as useful in trying to in the beginning of the stages is trying to work out what they should do. So, you know, that's often but yeah, you know, you use every tool that's there. And if it gives you a small number of things, then that's fine. But, you know, the case studies of, you know, Nespresso and these kind of things are they you know, it's all very symmetrical and beautiful when you tell the story. But, you know, I don't know whether if they had used the tool in the beginning, you know, would it have sent them in that direction? So that's, you know, but I mean, look, we started this conversation by complaining that there were no tools and models out there. So now I can't complain about the ones that are there.
Totally. So, Joe, let's go to the typical questions we have in this podcast, Business of Collaboration. So what is innovation for you?
Oh, great. Innovation is connecting the unconnected. So huge, 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 huge mistake is confusing invention and innovation. Invention,
Totally.
Invention is like, you know, maybe we should have something to stick this out of this conversation, but you know, something that's invented can take 30 years to go arrive on a supermarket shelf from a laboratory or something. So, you know, this is what I mean about Bill Clinton and like, you know, that a lot of things are already known but not connected. So innovation is connecting the connected, and scaling in particular, right, is taking your prototype or your kind of result of your experiment and dividing it up into things that can then working with partners in order to make them happen. So, you know, this idea that you would build a logistics or you would build anything, you know, it's asking, because the problem is you have to then scale 8 parts separately, which is really hard to do. So, you know, what you need to do when you hit product market fit is divide up, you know, your business model into components and then identify people to work with and say, you know, you are going to be our hosting, you are going to be our whatever, you're going to be whatever. And then you work with those people to deliver your service. And then they have the capacity, because they're experts in the customer won't see the stresses you're under. But it's a huge kind of issue I see all the time about people who hit kind of operational snags, which is because they've tried to, I mean, there is a thing which says that, large scalable systems only emerge from large stable systems only ever emerge from small stable systems. In other words, that you have to work it out first at the micro unit and then transfer that to the macro unit. So when you work it out in the micro, then you break it up into different components and then work with partners, because there's a lot of things that just other companies do better than you do. And you just should let them do it, because then they will retain leadership in that. So that's a kind of a huge issue in terms of innovation. Innovation is connecting the unconnected. It's finding ways in which you can deliver a service to somebody by working with other people. And that's sort of, and of course, the other thing is and this isn't the question you've asked, but I think sustainability is a much more interesting word than innovation. You know, I think the word innovation has been used in circumstances, and Peter Drucker was a big guy for popularizing it. But I think sustainability is, unless an innovation is also sustainable, it's not an innovation that you want to build a business on. Many companies are innovative. In other words, they connect the unconnected, but they're not sustainable. They're using resources that have a finite limit. And we shouldn't champion those. I was reading yesterday an article in the Harvard Business Review, and it started off saying every company wants to be like Amazon, Alibaba, and he picked another one as well. And I was like, hold on a second, like there are issues with all of those companies. Yeah. Why are we always holding those people out to be, the experts? And then just also so I was kind of, I made a kind of a comment on it on LinkedIn, but I couldn't resist that, we hold up these kinds of companies that manage to kind of do something, manage, regulatory arbitrage, or, find something that, they can do, but eventually the governance catches up with them, and what then? So your innovation must connect the unconnected in a sustainable way, whereby you're working with the ecosystem rather than against it. Totally. And maybe that will take longer, but there's all these sayings. Like I spend an awful lot of time studying nature and how nature equilibrium works in nature. And there's, these sayings that, nature takes its time, but everything is accomplished, and you, when you start to study nature, it is quite amazing. You see all of these things. Anything that grows fast can collapse fast. And we see that again, that also complicated, this kind of simplicity scales, complexity kills, a lot of these insects remain very small, because their body have all these kind of antennae floating around the place and things like that. And then you have like blue whales and giraffes that are not complicated animals. And that's why they're able to get bigger. And there are reasons for that around transcending energy around the body and things like that. But yeah, nature is fantastic to study. The other thing I'd say is I have this paper on fish farming that I quote all the time, that when farmers try to make fish grow faster and bigger, like the disease levels were increased.
Yeah.
So that's kind of similar to this idea that if you try and make a company grow faster than the natural rhythm of it, it's unstable. Yeah. So, that's another reason you shouldn't do it.
Yeah. Yeah. You can feel it. I think how you can be aware of this and take action, not to say, not now, maybe later. So, and as you are mentioning a lot, innovation relates to collaboration. Mm-hmm. So I think you were making the simile here. So now to the super quick questions. What is your favorite place for holidays?
Marrying a Spanish girl, you not only agree to love, honor, and obey, but also to go to her pueblo every summer. So we go to a little town called Puente de Ume in Galicia. Which I'm very happy about that, because it's a beautiful town. It's by the Atlantic Ocean, which is where I grew up. And But yeah, I have some friends who have married Spanish girls who are from like small towns in the Meseta, and it's not as nice to go in the summer, but that's what they have to do. So we go there to Punta de Umme every summer, and it's magnificent, really. I mean, the slogan for Galicia is "Can you keep the secret?" You know, "Escuadra es el secreto," and it's very true, because most people who come to Spain, which after all is the second most visited country in the world, you know, they go to the Mediterranean or the Sur. You know, they don't go to the north. Yeah. But there are parts of Galicia which are absolutely indistinguishable from Ireland. You could be looking at them and they're absolutely the same in all ways. So it's sort of like Ireland with better food and better weather. So, you know, that's a good combination.
Yeah. And do you have a routine in the mornings? How does your morning look like?
I mean, that's a sort of an interesting thing. I mean, would I get away with saying that I get up and I meditate, and or would that pass the smell test? I would say, I mean, that my productivity tip is just have one complete day where you've no meetings whatsoever. Yeah. I think that's, you know, try and bulk all your meetings in consecutive days, even if they're one after another, and get through them all. And then you just have one day or even 2 days when you just don't have any external commitments. You can like let the day develop as it was. I tend to sort of get my teaching done in the morning and then like work in the afternoons with the other things I need to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was wonderful. Like when I'm traveling, one of the great things about traveling is that you do like a breakfast meeting in the morning, and then you might have a company visit, and then you have the rest of the day free before you have like a company, an event in the evening. So you could go to somewhere like Rabat and you'd have the afternoon free to do some tourism and stuff. Yeah. It was really wonderful. My Instagram is wonderful. I look as if I have a wonderful life. And I think productivity is really important. In the same way that things I laughed at, like coaching and productivity and those kind of things are really important. I always, my big kind of fake is if you go out drinking, before you go to bed, drink at least a liter of water. You know, that's my big kind of like, you know, because otherwise you're just going to feel horrible the next day. But I like to go running at night.
At night?
Yeah.
I like the mornings because then you are already.
Yeah, but I like the dark. I love like running in the darkness. So I do a lap of a circuit of the Retiro every evening. Well, 5 times a week I do a circuit of the Retiro. It's about 5 kilometers, and it's quite nice because it's running in the darkness. And then sometimes I run inside the Retiro and it's really dark and spooky. And there's a statue of the devil, like one of the only statues in the world of the devil is in the Retiro. So it's sort of creepy to come up towards it at night, you know. Even I'm a bit like, I don't never make direct face contact, you know. But it's at 666 meters, so it's above sea level. So that's where the statue of the devil is. So it should be in a John Grisham book or something like that. But I don't have a good answer to your question about the morning routine.
Yeah, coffee or tea?
Coffee in the morning, tea in the afternoon. I also drink 4 liters of water a day. So I drink 2 liters in the water in the morning and then 2 liters in the afternoon. I used to do a lot of mountaineering, and you know, because in mountaineering you can't dehydrate, it's very dangerous, you know, you make bad decisions. So because of that, I've just got into the habit of drinking a lot of water. I think it's the other kind of productivity tip is that before I go to bed every night, I identify what I need to do first thing the day after.
Yeah.
And sometimes I will even have like the document. So if I need to do like expenses or something like that, I will actually have it all set up so that it's waiting for me when I get up the following morning, because otherwise, you know, you'll just flick on the internet and you'll start reading and that kind of thing. So so that's the sort of tip, which is that you work out before you go to bed every night, you work out the thing you're going to do first the following morning.
Yeah, totally. Very good tip. So what are you doing with your spare time on the weekends?
Yeah, I mean, I work 7 days. There's no real kind of...
That's the thing of the professors. And yeah. I think that it's not known. Like, yeah. You as a professor, academic, you are working...
The only time I have to do any work is the weekends. You know, the rest of it is kind of, you know... I often take between on Fridays, I take between like 6 and midnight off almost every, you know, weekend. So I have that kind of thing whereby, you know, I'll open a bottle of wine, get a pizza and watch Netflix or just do something that kind of is totally marks the end of the weekend. And then, of course, Saturday morning, you're up and you're grading papers or preparing classes or, you know, something like that. But I mean, we do have some, you know, sometimes you might on Sundays, we might go to the mountains or something like that. But, you know, in general, that's just the reality like that when you, you know, prepare. I have a lot of kind of work speaking at conferences or things that are outside of my main job. That means that I, you know, it's 7 days. That's just the way it is. But like when I like what I'm doing and I do like what I'm doing, it doesn't feel as if it's a big sacrifice.
No.
So I can understand why if you didn't like your job, you would like take it off completely mm-hmm. when you didn't have to do it. But that's not the way I feel. Yeah. You want me to put together a presentation on innovation. I mean, I find that an interesting piece of work, you know?
Yeah.
So like, well, you know, compare the Indonesian ecosystem with the Thai ecosystem, you know,
that's really
interesting piece of work, you know,
for the freaky of innovation out there. Yes.
Yeah. And then of course I read a lot of newspapers. So, I mean, I have to read the Irish newspapers, English newspapers, American, French and Spanish newspapers. So, you know, that's a lot of reading. So you've got to get through everything, but you know, it's amazing how, you know, a bit like I was saying about talking to people from Armenia, just knowing, you know, the name of something about their country and things like that. I mean, it can really impress someone, you know.
Yeah.
I remember, I mean, working in Texas and, you know, a guy telling me like there's a Paris in France as well, mm-hmm. you know, this kind of stuff, you know, like, or just people not knowing who the Chancellor of Germany is, you know, it's the same woman for 20 years, you know, how like, this kind of things. And you do find, I mean, that's one of the things about Silicon Valley. A lot of the people are very dull, you know, like I was reading, there's a, you know, Harry Stebbings has this, the 20-minute VC podcast, and not to be flagging rival podcasts or anything, but he's interviewing a lot of the European entrepreneurs like Jose Neves from Farfetch.
Oh, yeah.
Like they're all really interesting people, you know, they're, and then he interviews some American founder, and he's got like nothing to say about anything. It's all about like, you know, execution and, you know, like these kind, like just sort of, you know, like intermittent fasting, you know, like Jose Neves talks about like philosophy and, you know, these kinds of things. And I lived in Silicon Valley for a while. So I'm you know, I good luck to them. You know, they do. And I meet some of them at conferences and things like that. And to be fair, you know, like they kind of, everyone's very polite and things like that. But I just find that if you talk to all the unicorn people and even the investors, like the guy, you know, Nico Zenstrom and Stripe, Jonas, you know, even in Spain.
Yeah, I did once.
Yeah, well there's the guys in Stripe, but you know, Juan D'Antonio in Cabify, you know, he's an interesting guy. You know, he lives in a small apartment in Tetuan. You know, he's able to talk about what's happening in the world. You know, he's a very kind of you know, he's quite a thoughtful guy. You know, he isn't just a like Travis Kalanick, you know, like squash and then tell him you've squashed him and then squash him some more, you know, like it's sort of like, you know, algo de vomito, as they say in mm-hmm. Spain. But so that's the thing, you know, and you can, you know, the Americans listen to it are free to disagree and stuff. But the European founders, the people who've created unicorns in Europe are all really interesting, you know, people. Mm-hmm. I think that shows. Mm-hmm. And actually it's, and I don't know a lot about China, but, you know, Jack Ma and Pony Ma and these, they seem to be interesting people as well, the people who've done exceptional things in China. But, you know, like Mark Zuckerberg, who I have met, actually. And he was like, so, you know, I asked him about Obama, you know, it was the day before Obama was about to be president. And, you know, it was like, you know, looking for some sort of significant, like, historic event, first, you know, African-American president. The only thing he could say, oh, yeah, he's on Facebook. Like, that was, like, the only thing he could say about Obama. Like, he viewed the world into, there were people who were on Facebook and people who were not on Facebook. And, like, he couldn't, the sense of the significance of this as being, how would you feel if you were, you know, someone who'd been discriminated against through civil rights, and then you saw, you know, a black man entering. I mean, what an amazing historical moment that must have felt. And he just didn't seem to understand beyond. And, you know, that's what makes them good executors. You know, it doesn't make them very interesting people.
Mm-hmm. So thank you very much, though. I don't know if you want to say a last sentence to all the entrepreneurs.
My message is, you know, I'll give you like just two or three quick things, because obviously you get asked this a lot. Like the first thing is, you know, take your time, you know, don't worry that if it all is not coming together in your 20s, in your 30s, even in your 40s, you know, that's quite important. The second thing is like become a lunatic questionnaire person, you know, like just become a questioning machine, because, you know, you can probably give an infinite time, work things out by yourself, but you don't have infinite time. So get really used to being, I was just saw a guy yesterday who sold his company, and he's the most annoying guy in the world. Like, you know, he was ringing me on my mobile at like, you know, 1 a.m, and I hardly knew him. But, you know, he had that intensity because, like, you know, I could help him with something, and you, I'm not surprised he was so successful, because he, you know, that was his kind of attitude, you know, he was very much so. Become, I'm not saying everyone has to be like him, but in general, you know, take advantage of people who have passed through that road before and get the information from them, and that will sort of save you a lot of time. And then I guess the third one then is for companies, for corporate people who are connecting to us. And, you know, I always say that, like, corporations and startups, like, together, it's beautiful. They, you know, corporations don't need to become more like startups, and startups don't need to become more corporations. There's a sort of, you know, let startups do innovation and let corporates do, you know, distribution and scaling. So, you know, I find that problem a lot, where you have corporations trying to be something else. So, you know, let the invent in most cases, you know, buying startups and then just putting that into your value chain is very good business for corporations. So that's, you know, something I feel kind of strongly for, that they should sort of to work together. Yeah. So I don't know, those are sort of three things. You know, and you know, be not, you know, the other, you're, I don't know whether you're trying to make me go all nostalgic and weepy and, you know, hug your children and stuff like that. You know, don't be too hard on yourself. It's just a big thing. Like, I see a lot of people and they're very, I'm not perfect either. I wouldn't try to be perfect. And sometimes I haven't done stuff, but, you know, whenever I let people down, it's not, I don't get any joy out of it. It's just that there was another priority at the time. Mm-hmm. But just don't be too hard on yourself. And that, I think, I find far too many people are too hard on themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a sort of a good note to leave it on.
Thank you very much, Joe Haslam, for all your knowledge, for sharing everything you know and all these tips, because I think this is super useful for companies who are innovating to understand entrepreneurship as well. Okay. Investors to understand entrepreneurship and to startups and scale ups.
Fantastic. It's been an absolute pleasure, and it's really good that you take your time to put this together. And, you know, I grew up in a country that had one TV channel that was on for half the day. And the fact that we can do all of this is just wonderful. take your time to do this. And every time, the other thing, I say this to people in my class as well, which is, you know, some people say, no, I just like to listen. And I don't think that, like, your brain is divided in two, the active. And if you only listen, you only use half of your brain. So you have to learn how to communicate. You have to, like, each time, you know, Richard Feynman always says, you know, that's why it's by teaching you learn. And every time I sit down and I explain something, I get better at explaining it.
Totally.
And on that basis, you know, take every advantage, every opportunity you get to, you know, to be on podcasts. And that's how you get good at things.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Muchísimas gracias. Un placer. Y suerte con todo.
Yeah. Muchas gracias, Joe.
Thank you for listening to the Business of Collaboration podcast. And remember, if you want to support what we do, then share, subscribe, and leave a review over on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and Google Podcast. You can find a summary of this podcast at podcast.collabwave.org. See you next week.